Support for KMUW's Into Music podcast comes from McClelland, reminding listeners that Frank Sinatra coined the word skibbity in Strangers in the Night, which you can listen to in their downtown Wichita showroom. More info on McClelland's innovative sound, lighting, and video technology can be found at maxsound.com.
Hi, I'm Jed Bodwin, and you're listening to Into Music from the KMUW studios, part of the NPR Podcast Network. My guest on this episode is David J. Haskins. You probably know Haskins from his work with Bauhaus, Love and Rockets, and of course, from his extensive solo career. He will issue the new album, The Mother Tree, and a book of poetry, Rhapsody, Threnody, and Prayer, on June 6, 2025. Haskins, who's currently based in Los Angeles, recently discussed the origin of the album and the poems, which touch on a range of deeply personal matters, whether the death of his beloved mother or the estrangement between he and his stepson. That's David J. Haskins on Into Music, coming up now. Reading the poems and listening to the album, there's so many different locations. I wondered if, as a young man, you imagined that you'd go to all these places, or music was just something that happened to facilitate a lot of that.
Well, when I got into music, I mean, I wasn't thinking of it as a vehicle to travel. Only in my imagination it was, and you can't get a better vehicle to travel in imagination than music. But it was just, yes, a fortuitous side effect of being a musician is that you do get to travel and that you get paid to do it. So that's great, you know, and I enjoy traveling to a degree. I enjoy going to different places, being in different environments and the stimulation of that. And just going out, I've always loved just sort of going out and wandering on my own, you know, and getting lost and just seeing what adventures befall. Being a vagabond.
I wonder if you feel like that getting lost thing has been lost a little bit now with devices and so forth.
I think the mystery of place has become lost a bit. In fact, a lot, you know, because everything's so revealed and exposed, and there's so much less mystique and mystery, you know, in the world.
I agree. One of the things I loved about traveling as a child was our family would go someplace and we wouldn't know what the hotel looked like or something, right? When we were until we pulled up, and then it's like,
yeah, oh, that's right. You wouldn't know what the sea looked like. You know, you haven't seen many pictures of the sea. Isn't that really strange? You know, but it's true. It was exciting to see the sea. You know, oh, there's the sea. Because especially for us, because we're in the Midlands, right in the middle of the country, so we're the furthest from the sea. So the sea was a rare thing to experience.
So I wonder too if that's some of where that imagination was stored, because you were kind of in this space that didn't have that immediate access to things.
Sure. Yeah, the 70s was good for that. The 60s and the 70s, the fermentation of the imagination, the cauldron of the mystique, the mysterious, stirring of the mystery, the elusiveness of it all, you know. At least so much of that has been lost. I mean, and especially in something like music, where I think back to when I was first discovering music and when I was really into it, like when I was 14, early 70s. And the exposure to the things that I was fascinated by, like David Bowie and T-Rex and Roxy Music, you get little glimpses here and there. And if it was on TV, it was only on TV at that time for those 5 minutes and then it's gone. There's no like, oh, I can check that out later. No, you missed it, mate. And it was fascinating, you know. You get a picture of David Bowie in the magazine and you just like stare at it for a long time. And just your imagination would run riot, you know, making up stories that would feature that character. So now it's all, this is far too much that's available. So it kills all that.
I don't know how it had escaped me, but I had been listening to Pink Floyd for years before I finally saw a picture of the band, and I went, "Oh, that's what they look like." And then I was trying to match up, you know, who was who, because there was no like left to right, you know, Roger Waters, whatever. It was just like, okay, which one is that, you know? So with this album and book, you've kind of mentioned that this is your maybe your most personal work. So what made now kind of the right time to dive into that and explore some of the things that you do on the album?
Well, you see, this was—I mean—was recorded some time ago. It was recorded during the COVID times, and that was the right time to do it. I mean, there were components that came into place to make this thing happen. I wrote the poems when I wrote them because I'm compelled in that moment to write those particular pieces, and then they just, you know, they're filed away. But I had it in mind to record one of those poems, which is the long one about my mother, the title track, The Mother Tree. I had the idea to put that to music. I wasn't sure what that music would be or how I would make it, whether I'd just do it myself or bring in other musicians. I thought maybe I'd just do it myself and do like multi-tracks. Anyway, it was on the back of my mind to do that recording. And then I met a friend of mine in LA in an Indian restaurant. I hadn't seen her for a while, Nora Keys. I got chatting with her, and she's a really interesting artist, musician. And I asked her what she was doing. She said, "Oh, I've got a new group, a duo. We're playing tomorrow night downtown, this place called Ham and Eggs. And some other artists on as well." She said, "Come down." So I did. So I just went down on my own, and I saw her set, and I really liked it. And I was getting ready to leave, and these other three guys were setting up. And I thought, "Oh, I'll see what these are like, and I'll just probably stay for a song." And they launched into their first number, and then I was just completely riveted by what they were playing. And they were called Rakia, Raqia. And it means it's a Hebrew word, and it means the spiritualist, something like the unobtainable, just the spiritual manifestation of a core spirituality that you're reaching for but that you cannot attain, something like that anyway. And their music was very spiritual, and they were obviously, it was semi-improvised. I could tell that that was going on, but they really knew what they were doing, and they were very connected, and they were obviously really listening to each other, and it was very nuanced and subtle. And I love what they were doing. I thought this could really work with this spoken word idea, you know. And I wondered if they'd be open to collaborating with me, maybe even play on songs as well. So I approached them after the set, and they were. And then we were in the studio within a couple of days, and that resulted in the Mother Tree track. And then everything really shut down. Including the studio that we were using. And so we weren't able to resume for a while. But as soon as we could, we did. But it was different, you know, it was a different set of circumstances. We were wearing masks and we had to be isolated and all that. It was weird. But even that sort of, it gave it a weird kind of tension that was there to be used rather than there to spoil. I believe in using whatever situation you're in to your own advantage, you know. And I think if you have that mindset, I think you can naturally do that. You don't have to try too hard either. It just becomes apparent of how you should use these adverse conditions that are not, maybe they're not adverse, you know. Anyway, so we did record the rest of it, and very quickly, in 2 days. And then I would just went in for 2 days and mixed the whole thing. So I had this sitting on the shelf for a while since, because we finished it in 2020. And then I'd worked with Erotitox Records in the past. They put out one experimental piece of mine, and they did a really nice job with the presentation of it and the quality of the vinyl. And I liked Chandra, who runs the label, very much. And he was interested in doing something else with me. And so I was thinking, well, what could fit that label? And I thought, well, spoken word stuff could really suit. And I sent that to him, and he really liked it. He wanted to do it. So that's how it came about. And then it's just how long it takes to manufacture, you know. And so really, it's not that worked out that it's going to come out this time. It's just a matter of circumstance, accident, and procedure. But it feels like absolutely the right time. It really does, you know. And I have a little window of freedom, relative freedom, where I can now promote this, do things like this, and go out and play some live shows to promote it as well, which I'm going to do in June when it's released. Just a few, like a little mini tour, and play unconventional venues and play with unconventional guest artists. So it'll be every night will be different. I'm going to have clowns, I'm going to have magicians, I'm going to have other poets. Yeah, it's going to be fun for all. Something for everyone.
The Mother Tree, the music to me was just so elevating and emotive. And then, of course, the poem, the words come in over that. And I was just listening to the story and feeling like this, kind of floating through time and able to see the images and everything. It was really extraordinary. So, but you had written that quite some time ago, yeah?
I wrote it when my mum passed in 1997, like the day after she'd passed. But I started writing it then. I didn't finish it until a few months later after I'd released her ashes. And then, as you know, I talk about that, where those ashes went. Then it was complete.
Because it has that immediacy. It was sort of like I was thrown back to the morning after my father died, which was in 1995, and I had this similar kind of just like spilling forth of language and these kind of sometimes strange images, like, why am I thinking about that? What is it about that moment, And that poem really felt very much that way to me.
Yeah, all that stuff churns up, when the subconscious comes into play. And it's all part of, I think it's just part of processing it all, And if you are of an artistic ilk, then you tend to gather that in and record it and then release it and share it, with the public. But you're really doing it for yourself. But it's a beautiful thing that it can be shared and it can give solace to those who are experiencing something similar.
So when you came back to those words after this period of time, I'm guessing that over the years you hadn't revisited the words that often, or maybe ever. Were there different things that resonated when you were setting it to music and so forth?
Well, the whole thing is it's so intensified with the music and that music in particular, and those players and how they listened so acutely and how they responded so beautifully and with such nuance and subtlety and power and dynamics that it brought it to vivid life for me. It brought it to life. And I don't think I could have read that more than once. It was just a first take. I only read it once. I've only said those words once. And I won't be doing that one in the live set. I might do that. I might read it one time and one time only towards the end of the year. We might do a special event. But you can hear, I can hear the emotion in my voice as I'm listening to it now. It's very emotional. What's more emotional than, losing your mother? I don't know. Can't think of much.
Yeah, that's what I've wondered if it still had the same weight, or maybe it sounds like maybe even more through time. So yeah.
The story that I just absolutely love, and it is inspirational to me, and it's true, is that, and I talk about it near the start of the piece, where during the war, when she was 18, she loved to go ice skating, and she was, she's a beautiful woman, and I could just see her in ice skating rink in Birmingham, which is where she was from. And that, I mean, the Germans, they bombed the hell out of that place. Because it was like the second, it was called the Second City after London, they really hammered it. And she was ice skating, and the air raid sirens went off, and she was so pissed off with it. And everybody just fled, and her friends were like, "Joan, come on, we got to go to the shelter," She said, "No, you go. I'm staying. I've had enough of it. I just want to dance." And she carried on, and just that this image. It's a cinematic image to me. It's so vivid of her dancing like figures of eight with all these bombs just searing down, the sirens wailing, and chaos and just calamity going on all around. And the bravery of that and the beauty of that, the defiance. Fuck you, Hitler. Fuck off, Nazis. It's like, this is art. I'm doing what I love. And there would be music playing. And I just love that image and what it represents, And it makes me, I deeply love her for doing that. How brave.
Was that the woman that she was throughout the rest of her life, do you feel like?
Well, deep down, but I mean, she was very suppressed by my dad, to be honest, and oppressed. And I hated him for that. He clipped her wings, and men are apt to do that. So I personally made it a point of never, never doing that with women.
What inspired the book of poems at this moment in time?
Well, that I mean, that book of poems is drawn from decades. I mean, the earliest one I wrote when I was 21, which is going way, way back, and the latest one was written a couple of weeks ago, actually, when the book was actually going to press and this idea came up. It's a poem called Aftermath. It just came to me and I wrote it, and I thought, oh God, I wish that was in the book. And then I sort of called up Chandra at the label and said, "Is there any chance I could stick this one in there?" And he said, "Well, it's at the press." And I said, "I know, is there any chance?" So we got it in there. But so this is a span of decades because I've never had a poetry book, and I don't write that much poetry. It's because it's mainly all lyrics with me, and it's a different thing. The focus is really on the lyrics. So the poetry is a sideline, and there's not that much of it. So this is really pr pretty much all I've written since 1980. Whatever, no, 1976, seven, no, 78, I think, earliest one. The
Wow.
earlier ones are the more erotic. Yeah. Well, there is a degree of eroticism to the later poems, but it's more restrained.
Funny how that works. So I wonder, in putting the book together, did you just well, you wouldn't have gone chronologically, so you must have gone by emotion. And how did that differ, for instance, than putting together an album?
Very similar. It's sequencing in a very similar way. And it's very much the track that precedes, what does that suggest as far as the track that follows? So all of that comes into play, and then just tones. There's like the tone and a shift of the palette and where you want those colors to go. And it's divided into three sections. The first one is rhapsody, and it's very loosely rhapsodic. I mean, there are some pieces in there that are quite dark. The one I just mentioned, the very last one, the aftermath, that's quite dark, but it has a dark beauty. And to me, that's kind of rhapsodic. So that's why it's in that section. I mean, it involves a motorcycle crash in which the rider is almost killed and he's covered in blood. And it was something I experienced when I was a kid walking home from school when I was nine. It was 1966. And it was a summer's day, mid-afternoon, and I could see a Mr. Whippy ice cream van in the distance, and that was my favorite ice cream. And but there was something not quite right about this Mr. Whippy. And as I got closer, I could see, oh, yeah, that's not right at all. What had happened was a motorcycle had somehow taken off and embedded itself in the van, like through the window where they serve the ice cream. And the back wheel still spinning, shattered glass all over the road and the pavement, catching this sunlight. And it was just like they were like diamonds. And then this guy in black leathers, his helmet was over the road, covered in blood, just soaking blood, and with holding his hands like this, sitting on the sidewalk, and the sun beating down. It just happened, so there was no ambulance there yet. And there was a kind of stillness, an eerie stillness, and it was beautiful. And I remember feeling that's why it's rhapsodic. And it was a very strange feeling. I went into an altered state of consciousness. I was like, I disassociated and I was high, you know. And it was a very, and I felt in a way sort of a little bit guilty, but not really. I was just seeing it in a very pure way, in a I was seeing some sort of strange beauty in this scene, although it was horrible. So that's what that poem is about. And this, I'm going to do this piece live. I've recorded a version of it as well, reciting it, and I wanted to come up with some music to go behind it. And the distinctive Mr. Whippy ice cream van music was Greensleeves. That's what they would play. But it's like a little, a kind of electronic music box version. And I actually tracked down a recording of that from the 60s. And I looped it and slowed it right down, time stretched it. And it sounds so eerie. And you get all these harmonics and weird. It almost sounds like it's underwater. And it's perfect. So I shall use that when I do it live as well as a backing.
Oh,
So
wonderful.
there's that, and the other section is threnody, which is the sad ones, and there's lots of those, you know, and elegies and just tributes to the dead, and my mother's one starts that section, and then at the end there's prayer. And most of those, in fact, nearly all of those, are prayers for my estranged stepson, who has had a history, a long history of mental illness. It's a brilliant man. I mean, incredibly brilliant, but is bipolar, and it's all about that. And it's prayers for him.
I'll close on this very, very quickly. You do write, of course, about people you've encountered, people you've known. And sometimes I feel like if I were to write about some people I've known, it would change the outcome based on the day. Because sometimes I'll give you an example. I discovered over the weekend that I had this very close friend and we had a falling out. And I was very angry with him for a long time. And I realized, you know, I'm not angry at him anymore. I love him, but we're never going to be friends in that same way again. And if I wrote about that, it would be very different than 2 years before when I was just seething with anger, you know? So I wonder if sometimes it is that thing where it's like, this is another way to view a relationship or a meeting or something like that.
Sure. Yeah, and also it can be a way to come to terms with it and to, like I was saying, processing, you know? I mean, I had a very complicated and difficult relationship with my dad. And the poem was a way of, to a degree, although I had made my peace with him while he was still around, but it was something of a consolidation of that place of appeasement and coming to terms. It's a way of sealing it in a way, and in revealing it to oneself and potentially to whoever comes across it and can relate to it, and they can take from it and use that, you know. I mean, that's part of the function of art, isn't it?
I'm Jed Bodwin. You've been listening to a conversation with David J. Haskins. Haskins has two new projects coming out, the album The Mother Tree and the book of poetry Rhapsody, Threnody, and Prayer. Both arrive on June 6, 2025. You can learn more about him and his various projects at davidjhaskins.com. Our digital producers are Carly Cooper, Beth Golay, and Hugo Fan. Our theme music is composed and performed by Torin Anderson. You can learn more about this podcast and all programming on our station by visiting our website, kmuw.org. Send us your questions and comments at info@kmuw.org and find all the latest programming notes on that website as well. Thanks again for listening. We will see you next time.
Planet Money helps you understand the economy. We find the people at the center of the story.
Garbage in New York, that was like a controlled substance.
We show you how money influences everything.
Tell me what you like by telling me how you spend your money.
And we dig until we get answers.
I had a bad feeling you're going to bring that up.
Planet Money finds out. All you have to do is listen. The Planet Money podcast from NPR.